The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372. Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, radio for the imagination. Thanks so much for listening to the show and helping us celebrate all things creating and stories. We are going to tune our imaginations together today, and I've got a great story for you. I want to start just with a little introduction. My mind likes to make connections, and so this week, here are the three things I was making connections with. I read an article from NPR called "A Former Navy SEAL Went to College at 52. His Insight Led to a New Class." That was the title. Imagine being 30 years older than the students in your college classes. He had an impressive career as a member of the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, and NPR had talked to him as a freshman and now as a senior. And the one thing he would tell his younger self is, "You've got a lot to learn." He also learned that literature had been the connective tissue between humans for thousands of years, and he sees that humanity as the through line of life. And here was the key, the quote that was in the piece that really caught my attention. "Humans and their choices, good or bad, are more common than we realize." I love that he saw that insight, and I think that those connections are really important to us. If you want to know more, you can check it out. His new class that he developed as a result of all that learning was a look at the U.S.-Afghanistan withdrawal, and he learned from that if you've got to talk to people, that you do have to talk to people. That means people from all sides, even when it's hard, even when you think you don't want to hear what they want to tell you. Also this week, I went to Content Bookstore and with an event with author Julie Schumacher, whose latest book is The English Experience, the last in her academic mishap collection. And this time, Professor Jason Fitger is supervising a group of students heading abroad to London. And you can imagine all the antics that happen. The story is funny and witty and shows us how important human connection is. The story and the conversation at the bookstore brought me back, of course, to my experiences traveling in Spain. And I suppose I was like some of those American tourist kids, right? I was the traveler who wanted fun experiences and the learner who wanted to understand the language and the culture, but didn't realize how far I had to go to achieve that goal. I had a lot to learn about the world. And now I'm the mother that had sent her son on a trip to Europe this summer. And I know that he had fun, and I assume he learned a lot about life. I'm still waiting for him to process all of that and kind of do some reflection on that experience and those weeks that he was immersed in that world, because I don't think I've heard all of his stories and insights. And also sitting there, I realized I'm the more mature woman who can see that those teachers who chaperone student trips are the most amazing people on the planet. They help us to make those stories, memories, and lasting connections. And the last thing that happened to me that I was trying to figure out, this has a connection somewhere, was that I was walking back downtown towards the library, and I found a rock, and a little rock just sitting on a post. And that rock had the word choice written in black marker on that polished stone. And I wondered if I was supposed to pick it up or just admire it. It was just a small little rock, and my walking companion reminded me that I had a choice, and it seemed like the first test of many that stone will present for me. So how to connect these experiences from this week? My mind likes to discover how things make sense, and I think reading and choosing to read are one common thread. I always want to bring more reading and stories into my world and into your world. I'm reminded my kids, I thought about this week. It had this time that they called deer time at school, which was drop everything and read time. We could learn a lot from the teachers and kids that take the time out of their days to read. Imagine if we each took a portion of our visual media time and used it to enter a written story. I believe reading will get us through whatever we're going on in this world or going through. We can make honest and heartfelt and soul-binding connections with other humans through reading. This may be the best way to discover what you've got to learn about the world. Books help us feel less lonely because we can discover that other people have felt and experienced the same things. And you have to be open to making connections, even if we're unsure or uncomfortable exploring that character or that topic or that place. And that's something that is really important to remember, is to do it anyway. So I think reading is always a choice. I want to thank all the authors in the world. They all enter their imaginations with courage to bring out to life the stories that help us make these connections. I say that authors and librarians and booksellers and teachers and book lovers and readers and book club members are my superheroes. And that's why I'm so excited to welcome to Art Zany Radio author Gretchen Anthony. Gretchen Anthony is going to be in town in Northfield to talk about her recent book, The Book Haters Book Club, and preview for us on Art Zany Radio her presentation at the Friends and Foundation of the Northfield Public Library annual meeting, a talk entitled Great Stories Lead to Great Stories, How Real Life Informs My Fiction. Gretchen Anthony is the author of The Kids Are Gonna Ask, a recipient of the 2021 Alex Award from the American Library Association. Her debut novel, Evergreen Tidings from the Baumgartners, was a Midwestern Connections pick and a Best Books pick by Amazon, BookBub, Pop Sugar, and the New York Post. And author J. Ryan Stradall, who was just here, it feels like it was just a couple weeks ago, it was probably a couple months ago, called her latest book, The Book Haters Book Club, the feel-good book of the year. And The Book Haters Book Club, which all you need to know is that it takes the right book to turn a book hater into a book lover. This is the story of Over the Rainbow Bookshop, and I am so excited to welcome Gretchen Anthony to Art Zany Radio. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you for having me. What a lovely introduction.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love to find the way things connect. And I think that's probably something that you did in this book, too, because there's so much life in this little community of the bookstore and the neighborhood where all things happen in this book. And I have a sense, because there's so many book recommendations in this book, in addition to all the family and community pieces, it's a love letter to everybody who loves books. And I wondered if how you knew that you loved books, you know, when you were growing up. How did you know that that was going to be the place where you spent your time?
That's such a great question. I grew up in a family that cherished books and encouraged it. My brother once told the story that the only excuse for getting out of household chores like mowing the lawn or helping around the house was if you were on the couch reading a book.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and I'm a master procrastinator, so that could have been my early introduction. But I grew up in Richfield, Minnesota, a suburb of the Twin Cities, and I have distinct memories of spending my summers biking to the Southdale Public Library, part of the Hennepin County library system, and it was my happy place. Mm. It really was. It was, this was back in the 70s, we didn't have air conditioning at the time, but atmospherically, everything about the library brought me joy, because it would be summer, and there was a long hill between there and my house, and I would be hot and sweaty, and I'd walk into the building, and they had air conditioning. And to this day, I think there's something magical that they put in the water, in the drinking fountains, because even the water tasted great. And I could spend hours upon hours upon hours finding my little happy place and reading books and, you know, watching movies. And so It was ingrained. I think it was ingrained in me from the very beginning. And part of it, I want to tell you a story that your introduction reminded me of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because even though I give my parents and my upbringing a lot of credit for turning me into a book lover. I think it's also something that you're just innately drawn to or born with. I think it's part of your personality, you know, what your brain is willing to zoom in on and grab a hold of to relax or to engage. Because our oldest, we have three boys, and two are in college now, so, you know, they're all pretty much well on their way. And our oldest, we used to get calls from his elementary school teachers because they would say, we can't get the books out of his hand. Like, we have to take books away because he's not paying attention in the rest of the class. And so we had to deal with that for our oldest. And then 2 years later for our middle, he's not a reader. I mean, we eventually found books that he was willing to read, but when he was in first grade, our elementary school had this great program called dot reading, and they asked for parent volunteers every Tuesday, I believe it was, to come into the classroom and spend 45 minutes as a one-on-one reading mentor, because the dots were like in colors, and you would graduate from blue to red and red to green and things like that. And so everybody had their own individual level that they were reading at, and our job as a parent volunteer was to listen to the kid read out loud and help them with you know, words they might be stuck on or finding context. And for me, it was the absolute best connection for how to get involved in my kids' education, like how to volunteer for the schools, how to give back. It was such a natural fit for me. And I stepped up and I did it for Karsten, my middle kid, his class. And about a month or 6 weeks in, he came to me and he said, I want you to quit.
Oh, no.
I said, what? You have to quit dot reading. And I was like, but I love it. And it's such an important program. And he said, he wasn't quite this articulate, but at seven or however old he was in first grade, but he basically told me that school was his place. He didn't want mom in school. School was his place. And so I was presented with a choice where I thought, do I honor my kid or do I do something that I know is meaningful for the teachers and for the students? And ultimately, I chose to honor my kid. If school was his place, you know, I did that. And then I did volunteer for my third kid and in the same program, and he let me stay. And the teachers all gave me a razzing. They said, are you going to have to quit again? but it was not a choice that I ever would have anticipated being faced with.
Yeah, and that's a really fascinating story. I had a very similar experience, and we could go off on volunteering at schools. But I worked in the library, and my kids had mixed feelings about that. And I think that what's interesting to me is that actually it was your middle son, who you mentioned wasn't a reader, who actually provided one of those recommendations in this book.
Yes!
So it comes full circle.
He comes full circle. And the, you know, the interesting thing about that was he knew that reading was important to me. And that's why he recommended the book, because he knew me well enough. I think he was in third grade at the time. He knew me well enough to know that I would enjoy that book, and he recommended it to me because his teacher had read it to them aloud in class. And so, you know, he's not entirely turned off to books, but I do think there is something innate in us to what sort of story we gravitate to, because every human being gravitates to story. For him, it just takes a different form.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
I want to talk about the book because folks may not have had a chance to read it yet. I want to tell everybody about this book. It is a book with character voices that are memorable and lovable. And I thought what was interesting, one, the title, so we'll get to that. But I understand from your end notes that this book took a long time to sort of center and get, you know, land on the page for you. And you ended up with the Book Haters Book Club, which is a newsletter that Elliot writes. He's one of the owners of the Over the Rainbow bookstore. And I thought it was really a wonderful note that you had in the back, because I think, I forget what you had happen, explodings, what was it, something about you were, your ideas were all a mess.
Oh,
you didn't want your,
yeah.
You were pitching all kinds of things. So it was sewer lines blowing up and...
Yeah, when I first envisioned this book, I knew I wanted to write a story about a community coming together and a place that felt natural where that would happen. And for the same reasons that we just talked about, for me, that would naturally either be a library or a bookstore. And the idea of creating a bookshop appealed to me because as writers, we get to create our ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gave me the opportunity to create this ideal bookstore. And the idea was there, but then what happens? What has to drive the story forward? And my first thought that I pitched to my editor was that the inciting incident at the beginning was that in this neighborhood in Minneapolis, it takes place in Lynn Lake, on the block where the bookstore is located, the sewer line explodes and literally covers the entire neighborhood in, I won't say the word, in sewage.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, the bookshop is oddly spared. And so it becomes this place of refuge for the community, even more so than it was for its regulars. And I sent it to my editor, and she said, well, I love the concept of this being a refuge and a place for community. Do you really want your readers to have to read 300 pages about stinky sewage? I thought, no. So, but, you know, I will say the backdrop to when that idea came to mind was that I was conceiving of this book during the summer of 2020,
Pandemic
right after
time.
The murder of George Floyd
the absolute
destruction of the neighborhoods, and just watching as a Minnesotan and someone who was raised in the Twin Cities, watching people's homes and people's businesses and people's livelihoods get destroyed out of anger, and also because there were a lot of people who came in from other areas and out of state just as agitators. And it just felt so cruel and disheartening because the people who are already vulnerable and angry, then their lives were affected in more tangible ways on top of that. And so as a proud Minnesotan and Twin Cities resident, my heart ached. And we were in the middle of COVID, and the first draft of this book, not only did it start as an sewage explosion, and you can insert the word, but then I went on to write the first draft, and I think I finished the first draft in 2021, spring of 2021, because I took a break and I went back and read it. And what I discovered was that everyone was sick. I was killing off my main subjects, my main characters. And I had to write to my editor and say, I think I was, you can't read this. This isn't the book. I think I was working out some sort of trauma. And that's, you know, that's one of the wonders of writing too, is we just work things out on the page, and we hope that we can help readers work things out. But this was definitely my personal therapy on the page, and so I took a huge step back and rewrote the book. So I can guarantee to all your readers, or all your listeners, if you haven't read it, it is a happy book.
I can echo that.
Didn't start out that way.
Yeah, it's a very just uplifting and just it just takes you into that world of loving books. But also, I think what was really interesting, and this is probably how you landed on the Book Haters Book Club, that's a newsletter that Elliot writes, who works at the store. And I admire that way that you acknowledge that there are some people who aren't comfortable going into bookstores or don't know what to read next. And Elliot kind of takes that on as a challenge to help people find those books that are going to, you know, light them up and get them excited and or teach them something or be the right book at the right moment.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I knew that innately, but I remember having a conversation with my agent, and it came out in this conversation where we both agreed that even as a reader, we all have places that we wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable. You know, if you love romance, you might not be comfortable going into a real highbrow bookstore, or, you know, you walk into a science fiction bookstore and, you know, you might immediately feel as if you stand out. And so we thought, if we're going to create a place for community, how do we figure out how to overcome that? And Elliot in the book even alludes to that. He says, we don't have to be such snobs. We don't have to be, you know, book snobs. I think he says something like, if the drink isn't to your liking, just toss it out and get another one. You don't have to throw it in somebody's face, you know. So, I felt strongly about creating a space where everyone was could truly find a place there.
But what I love is that, so it's not just all happy and everything works great. There are a lot of obstacles here in this book. It centers on bookstore partners Irma and Elliot, and then Irma's daughters Bree and Lainey, and then Elliot's partner Tom. And I'm curious, each of them, just like, they're all so different, but so you're rooting for them as they, you go through the story. And I wonder which one of those characters came first, and how did you create such distinct voices? I mean, especially the difference between Bree and Lainey, the sisters, they're just, you know, polar opposites. They love each other, but man, they're just really on different, you know, wavelengths. Lainey's bold and says her mind and has retorts and just funny lines and snarkiness maybe a little. Bree's a little more, you know, hardworking, serious, just can't figure out this romance thing, how to flirt. And it's just there's so much to love about the book. So tell us about writing those and getting into those characters.
Well, that's just life, isn't it? I mean, we attract all sorts. And I always, even as a reader, I balk at books that are a little bit too perfect. I don't like a perfect bow as an ending. Mm-hmm. I like things to be a little bit messy and a little bit complicated, because that's, like I said, that's just life. And, but to answer your question about the characters, Lainey came first, without a doubt. And I think the reason for that is, according to my husband, who was reading an early copy of the book, he said, "This Lainey is the most like you character you have ever written." I remember he was reading it in bed, and I heard the book hit his lap, and I thought, uh-oh, what did I do? And he said, this is so much like you. And there is a lot like, you know, Lainey is a lot like me, but not entirely like me. She's very much, she's lively, and she has all the comebacks that I wish I would have. I have a lot of comebacks, but I don't have all the right ones. And she is a little bit snarky, and she uses humor as a defense mechanism, which I've been known to do as I've grown. And so she came to me very early, and there's a lot about the path that she took in life that is vaguely familiar to my own. But then Brie, Brie is what I have learned about writers are observers, right? We naturally just have our eye out and we watch people and we sort of listen to what they say and we think about them afterwards. And what I have always come to recognize is that you can't have two Lainey's be good friends because they're like, you know, they're like the wrong poles of magnets. They'll rub off against each other. You have to have just enough where they find solace in each other. But for every extreme in one person, there needs to be a polar opposite in order for them to fit. And so Brie naturally sprang from Lainey because all of Lainey's confidence, Brie has to feel unsafe. You know, Lainey and Brie compensate for each other, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And so, writing Brie was like writing an inverse of Lainey. And then Tom was just, I don't know. He's just all heart. I don't know where he came from, but he sure did touch my heart a lot. I have to say that Tom, because he's in mourning, he lost his partner about 6 months before the book starts, and he's deeply in mourning. A lot of that, my mom shared with me. Mm. After we lost my dad about 17 years ago now, but she was very open with me. I said, I'm writing this partner who's in mourning. And yeah, for example, there's a line about Tom goes to a grief support group and the grief support leader says, don't expect anyone who's experiencing a significant loss in their life to remember anything that happened yesterday or that they need to do tomorrow. They'll remember everything from when life was good. They'll remember things from 20, 30 years ago as if they happened yesterday, but don't expect them to remember that they need to file a very important piece of paperwork or that they have a doctor's appointment next week, because those things don't matter when you feel like you've just lost your life. Mm-hmm. That was from my mom, and I think even in a way that sentiment informed so much of Tom.
Yeah, you're right. And you have to have those balance points in books, and this one does a great job with that range of, you know, the real life sadness that happens, but then the humor that comes through, and that's what makes it like a real place. Like, I feel like there is an Over the Rainbow bookstore, and I want to go there because there's so much to love about that place and real people, you know, that you really get invested in their stories. And so that's your job at crafting this beautiful story. And for folks that are just tuning in, I'm talking with Gretchen Anthony, and we're talking about her book, The Book Haters Book Club, which is her latest book. And she's coming to Northfield. I think I forgot to mention the event time, so let's do that now. It is on Sunday, September 24th at 2 p.m. That's at the Northfield Public Library. It's an event for the Friends and Foundation of the Northfield Public Library. It's their annual meeting, which starts at 2, and then Gretchen will be doing a presentation at 2:30. And it is open to everybody. So I come learn about the library. If you love the library, this is a great organization to get to know. And you're giving a talk entitled Great Stories Lead to Great Stories, How Real Life Informs My Fiction. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. And some of that, you know, just like what your mother told you is really just, I mean, that's a real detail that really makes his grief feel like it's lived and an experience that someone else has gone through. And that's such a fabulous thing that you've added to the story. But I don't want people to think it's just about love and books. It's so funny. And I have to share with our listeners, I was laughing out loud reading this book. So, and you know, there's so many zingers in here that, I mean, we couldn't possibly, but one of my favorite, just to give people a sample, was that the sisters, Lena and Brie, are talking about Lena's been gone for a long time and out of the day-to-day life of Irma, the mother, and Bree has been doing everything at the bookstore and just, you know, feels like she's on top of everything. But Lena comes in thinking she might have a say. Lainey, did I say, I'm sorry, that was a typo.
Well, it's a very Minnesota name, and I respect the insertion. So go ahead, you can call her Lena.
I think that was... That was a typing error in my question, so my apologies. Gosh,
no problem. I love it.
How did that happen? Oh, that's funny. But then, so Bree is upset that her sister thinks she has a say, and she says this line: "All Lainey had to do was send a birthday card, and her mom practically farted thank you glitter." Just. I mean, it's just that is such a brilliant line. There's so much more of that in here. Humor can be really hard to write. And you mentioned, you know, just those comebacks that Lainey has, and those just even Tom has a few that, you know, kind of biting lines. And there's a lot of great stuff in here. So how do you work through that and get that so that that reads right and that other people are going to also laugh at those moments?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I know how to answer it.
Does it come from character, I'm thinking, maybe? That's where...
Yeah, I think a lot of it, though, in terms of... The problem with humor is scale, I think.
Mm.
It's either not enough or it's too much, and it's the reason humor is so difficult to write is because you got to hit it on the bullseye every time for it to work. And it's going to work differently with some things are going to work with some people and some things aren't going to work with others. And you got to find that Venn diagram of what's going to work for the majority. And I've had readers who just don't appreciate my sense of humor.
Oh.
You know, they think I'm making fun of the characters. And that's not true. I love my characters. I love my characters. But that's the nature of, you know, of we as human beings, we all interpret things differently. But I think the wonder for me, or the piece that works best for me, is that my editor is very good at, number one, she's from New York. And the thing about being a Minnesota writer is that Minnesotans are so quirky, they're lovable. Just we're so odd that it's wonderful, but in some ways that there's often things that we only understand, and then there's the Fargo the movie thing, you know, where there's a risk of making fun of us for our Midwesternisms, and so it's very helpful to have an editor who is not of my people, because she will either tell me I don't get it, or she'll say you're on the verge of getting silly. She often says, okay, this is silly, or this is too wacky, you know, scale it back a little bit. And then, I have a wonderful writing partner who named Josh Moling, who writes thrillers. And if you're into thrillers, his are great. And he just had a new one come out, shameless plug. I'm sure they're at Content Books. He often tells me that I'm pulling my punches, and he will highlight that. He'll say, you're pulling the punch. Don't give up so soon. And so much of, you know, what I think is funny is made better by my editors and early readers.
I think that's really good advice for any writer, to be able to think about, you know, people outside that world can reflect differently. And, you know, New Yorkers have their own sense, too,
right,
of the world.
Right.
And
she's originally from Maine, which I think even makes it even better.
That's so perfect. And it's also, I think you give us some hints, because it is a very Minnesotan book. And if you don't have to know Minnesota to love the book or the characters, but if you do, there are so many. I want to applaud you for this, because there's so many little, I don't know what I called them, like little memory drops is what I called them in the story, mm-hmm. that, you know, you'll, you know, she these, because it ranges from 1979, which is when Irma and Elliot first met, to when the bookstore opens in 1980, and then goes up to the present day. So there's that whole era of time to play with, I guess. And yeah. Little things like Dayton's comes up, and you know, it just makes you go, oh, yes! And the conference room that they meet in when they're talking about the sale of the bookstore is the Lake Minnetonka conference room. And you've got little slips in there about the Brady Bunch or orange polyester culottes, the Mall of America, Shaka Khan. I mean, it just was so much awesomeness. And I grew up in that era too. So I'm sure a lot of your readers just it just instantly creates these, like, I don't know, like something bursts inside of you and you have a flood of connection and memory to these characters because it's so real. So how did you know when to, you know, put those details in or scale back or you know, because they aren't central to the story necessarily. You could name the department mm-hmm. store anything, but it matters to those that know.
Those are just, I love the term memory drops. I call them Easter eggs.
Okay.
I throw them in there for people to find because it always delights me when I find things in books that I recognize. It's like watching a movie that was filmed in a place that you're familiar with. You're like, oh, there's, you know, such and such a place. I recognize it. I find that personally thrilling, so I drop a lot in there. Plus, you know, books tend to take place in very few places in the United States. They either take place in New York, or they're set in LA, or sometimes Florida. You know, there are very few books that take place in the most Midwestern you tend to get is Chicago.
Mm.
You know, and so if we're gonna, if I have a love of Minnesota. I have a love of having grown up in the Twin Cities. And so that's one of the little superpowers I have. I can drop the mention of one of my favorite Easter eggs in this book was that when Irma and Elliot, after a big thing that happens, they go to Charlie's.
Yes.
downtown for martinis. And I remember Charlie's growing up because that was always the fancy place
mm-hmm.
that if you were going to go celebrate something, you would go to Charlie's. And so, yeah, so I love it myself, and that's why I do it.
And
to share a little bit of Minneapolis with the rest of the world.
That's right.
And we don't get enough love.
It's so fun. So I want our listeners to know how much that is just a great, it just adds something magical to the book. And the Book Haters Book Club is what we're talking about. I'm Paula Granquist with Art Zany Radio. We're here with Gretchen Anthony. And one of the things I have to say, I've added to my to-be-read pile because of the book, because there are so many fabulous recommendations throughout the book. And so I want to thank you for that, because I found myself going, oh, I got to go look up that one. I don't know that one. Or, oh, I remember that. That was so fantastic. Something like, you know, Faith Sullivan, you know, we bring up in the early days of the bookstore, and, you know, a beloved Minnesota author. So there's a lot to learn about books in here. And I think in Northfield, we might be a little lucky and special because there are two local authors that are mentioned, both Ben Percy.
Yeah.
Is named in there, a reference to, I think, his werewolf characters in Red Moon. And then Kata Schwen gets a call out as well for The Rending in the Nest, which was so fun. How the writers responded who you've put into this book, and I bet there's some that said, why didn't you put mine in?
Well, that did worry me. That every time I tried to mention as many Minnesota writers as I possibly could, even if just in passing,
mm-hmm.
because we have a wealth of talent in this state. I mean, just a wealth, and it's a wonderful place to be a writer. It's a wonderful place to develop community. And that was exactly right. I was just paranoid about missing somebody, and I'm sure I did. But yeah, it's been fun. People You know, and I didn't really tell anybody that their name was mentioned in the book. So if they came across it, it was a, oh my gosh, thank you. You know, it was a fun little drop for them. It was an Easter egg for them.
That is so,
so but I also want to just mention that you have, well, I don't know, is it a spoiler to say who gave me those book recommendations, would you say?
That's a good question. I don't think so, because I think if you're interested in this book, you also love all those people. So maybe we can...
Let's
tell them.
So Elliot's newsletters, in which he recommends books, and they run throughout the course of the book, as I was writing those newsletters, I was making my own recommendations and, like I said, trying to draw on Minnesota writers, etc. But then I realized I was getting really skewed, and I remember sitting at my desk and putting my hand, my chin on my hand, and thinking, if only I had someone that I could email for recommendations. And then it was just like a palm slap to the forehead, because I realized I have so many people who I can ask for recommendations, because one of the wonderful things about, you know, being a published author is that you make new connections with all these booksellers around the country and librarians around the country, and it's wonderful. So I did. I reached out to numerous librarians and booksellers, and I said, I'm looking for a book that sort of fulfills this need, and what would you recommend? And I told them what I was doing, and then I promised to give their bookstore a call out in the book.
Aww.
Because I wanted readers to know that they were where they were coming from. They weren't my recommendations. They were booksellers and librarians are magicians. They're superheroes. I call them superheroes in my book because they do change lives. They honestly do. And so I wanted to make sure that proper recognition was given.
I appreciate
these are the people on the front lines.
Absolutely. So that's if, and I loved how in the end you get to learn how those recommendations came to be. And so there's some great bookstores that I was like, oh, I don't know that one. I've got to, because my family knows if we go on a trip, that's where I go. I go to the library or the bookstore and I check out, and they used to come with me more. Now they, Well, that's another story.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's a mom thing. Okay.
Right.
We'll pick you up in an hour.
Right, exactly. But, you know, at the heart of this, that this is a story, I think, about sort of being honest in our lives to the people who matter. I think Lainey's great line for me came towards the end of the book, or maybe I have it as page 217. Relationships don't survive without the truth. And
yeah.
I think... You know, and also then the other angle of that is, you know, it's how we get to define love in our lives. And Bree has a line that is, which I forgot to write the page down, but it's in one of my multiple, I was flagging so many pages in this book because there's so many great pieces of advice, book recommendations, great funny parts. She says, you won't really be anywhere until you know where you want to be. And so I just thought those were really beautiful way. I mean, so there's a big heart to this book. When did you know those things in the process, and how did that help you edit or shape the book or decide, you know, which characters stayed or how you, you know, developed the plot?
I think a lot of that stuff, it comes in intermittently. Some of it comes in early in the writing process, and it's a step in my getting to know the character. Because even though I try to do as much character development as I can before I go into the writing process, because it helps me work more quickly, it just helps me be more productive, it always without fail takes me at least a full complete draft before I recognize the characters.
Mm.
I have to get all the way to the end of the story until I think I recognize them and understand them. And often it's a little thing that came out maybe in their dialogue or in their inner dialogue that later I pick up on it and I think, okay, that's at the heart of this character, or that's what they want. And then when I find those little nuggets, then I try to add to them, because every character has to have an arc. They have to change at least somewhat over the course of the book. And where their heart is at the beginning often is what guides me to where they'll end up.
Ooh, I like that. I'm writing that down.
Well, thank you. Now, if only I could just live as perfectly in my real life.
And if it were just that one line that you could follow and it would take you to the rainbow, right?
Right.
There's, and the, folks, I'm looking at my questions. I'm like, oh gosh, I've got so many questions. So I'm going to have to save some of these for another time, because I'm just, we haven't even talked about the whole plot line of what happens to the bookstore and how it's threatened, and the way they get together to try to figure out how to make that. And that is a beautiful part of the story, because it's the entire block of stores and their stories get told to us too. And that adds just to the magic of the place and the people and the time. But I want to talk about Irma. She's the mom in the story, and she's the one who is the, you know, sole survivor, right, of the other Elliot. We learn right away, so I'm not giving anything away. We learn like in the first few pages, which I hesitate to, I'm not going to say how we learn it about Elliot in the first part of the book, because his voice and his story is original and fabulous. So incredible. But she's left alone now to figure out, what do I do with this bookstore? And what's really interesting, at the end of the book, she gives this advice to her daughters: ask the questions you need answers to. But the whole irony of the book for me was she never answers the questions that they have. So it's, yep. You live your life one way, but then you know what's right, but you don't always do the right thing in your own life. So she is hiding from them the whole time. What's going on? Why is she wanting to sell? What is her, you know, reason? Is it really about this condo in Florida and, you know, that she wants to do that? And so it's her character is, And yet you kind of get the sense from the early stories of when she and Elliot started the bookstore, just, you know, this vibrant, charming, and she's still really good at recommending books. But she's at the heart of the story, I think, and just a really memorable character. So what did you learn from Irma?
Well, I think you nailed it. It's so hard to live by your own, what you think is best. It's often hard to take your own advice, or it's often hardest to take your own advice. But the other thing I learned about Irma is, you know, I'm 52 now, and one of the things I look back on is just, again, going back to your quote, is that there's so much you don't know and so much you're willing to let go as you age, because it just doesn't matter. Mm. And Irma, when she says that to her daughters, ask the questions that you need answers to, one of the reasons she says that to them is because she has woken up and realized that she never asked Elliot questions that she really needed answers to.
That's true.
Irma is a flawed character. She has her own strengths. She's wonderful in so many ways. I mean, she literally changes so many lives. But, she's a very flawed character, and complicated by the fact that over the course of the book, she is deeply sad. She is deeply sad. Her life has fallen apart. She lost the partner to her bookstore. She lost her partner that she met late in life, and now she's losing her life's mission, which was her bookstore.